This is Yaron Brook, guest speaking on Dr. Leonard Peikoff's podcast. I'm here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. Your real-life questions specifically to current events, including politics, economics, and foreign policy. My answers are posted every other week on Mondays. Leonard will continue to answer questions, but now only on alternate Mondays. You can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes at www.peikoff.com. If you have a question to ask me, simply go to peikoff.com/questions. So this is a question about the relative size of the financial sector in a free private economy. And I think this refers back to a previous question I answered, where I might have said that in a free market, maybe the financial sector would be smaller or not. And he's making the case as, wouldn't the differences in a completely free banking with no Federal Reserve, wouldn't the differences between different banks and the fractional reserves they had create complexities and actually increase the size of the financial sector? I mean, my point is this. I don't know. I don't know how big or small the relative size of the financial, and it's not important. What's important is that the financial sector be free. Free of government regulation, free of government control, free of the government printing money, free of the Federal Reserve, that the financial sector should be free, and how it evolves, how it deals with the complexities that are created. Because you're right, currency issued by Citibank might be worth differently than currency issued by the Bank of Texas. And you'd need mechanisms to deal with that, which don't exist today. And you might have a derivatives market. You certainly would have a futures market in currencies. And so on, it would definitely create some complexities and some uncertainties, and you would have to deal with this. And contracts might be more complex. I tend to think they'd be less complex. But some things would go away, some things would be created, and the end result would be more freedom. I have no idea if that means bigger, smaller, or the same. Well, I know it's not going to be the same. Everything would be changed. The whole banking system, the whole way in which our financial system is organized would be altered. I mean, you guys don't have a clue on how deeply, fundamentally, every aspect of a financial world is regulated and controlled by government, from the way that stock market exchanges function and what they're allowed to do and not allowed to do. And all this drives all kinds of behaviors, and the way everything that banks do is regulated, everything investment banks do. The whole structure of the financial industry, the differences between different financial institutions, all of it is driven by regulation. If you eliminate those regulations, who knows how the financial industry would evolve? All I can tell you is it would be beautiful. Okay, here's a question. which do you see as being more the culmination of the influence of Immanuel Kant on the West, environmentalism or radical Islam? Now, given that radical Islam is not a phenomenon of the West, I'm assuming you mean here Immanuel Kant's influence on the response of the West to radical Islam. And in that sense, the influence of Kant is evident both in the environmentalism and radical Islam, because in both cases, what you see is weakness, no self-assertion, no self-esteem, reversion to irrationality as a response to both environmentalism and radical Islam. No ability to reason is an argument against either one of them. I mean, Kant has made possible the environmentalist movement, and he's made possible the weak Western response to radical Islam, which is, of course, is emboldened radical Islam. And he's done that by two fundamental ways. One is by undercutting the idea of the efficacy of reason. The whole Kantian epistemology is focused on convincing us that reason is not really a guide to reality. That reason has nothing to do with reality as it is, but is basically just a mind game. So the whole confidence of the West, if you will, the whole reason the West is superior to any other culture is reason, is its advocacy of reason, its veneration of reason, its veneration of science, the scientific revolution. That's what makes the West the West. Everything else is a sideshow. The West is the West because of Aristotle. The West is the West because of the Enlightenment, because of the rediscovery, the rebirth of reason in the West, the Renaissance and then the Enlightenment. And Immanuel Kant undercuts that and destroys that. And therefore, you can't challenge the emotionalism of the environmentalists. But Mother Earth told me, and Mother Earth is suffering, and Mother Earth is this and that. with no science, no scientific basis, no evidence, you know, it becomes just fear-mongering and emotionalism, which Immanuel Kant has left us open to, because if you don't have reason, all you have left is emotion. That's all that's left. And response to radical Islam is the same. How do we know we're better than them? How do we know we're right and they're wrong? How do we even combat them? What do we do about them? Maybe, you know, all cultures are the same. There's nothing superior about us. So Immanuel Kant has destroyed our capacity to defend ourselves. The other issue that Kant attacks is the issue of individualism and really the whole idea of an individualistic morality, a morality of egoism, of rational egoism. Because he says your moral duty, morality is a list of duties to other people. It's a list of duties that involve denying self. Well, that's exactly what the environmentalists ask for us. They ask us to sacrifice. They ask us to deny our own pleasure, our own selves, in the name of what? In the name of the environment, nature, fish, worms, rats, whatever, right? Whatever stands in the way of human happiness, that should be cherished. And that's ultimately very Kantian. And the radical Islamists say the same thing. It's sacrifice, sacrifice to God. Who are we to stand up against them? That would be very selfish and individualistic to stand up against them. Who are we to go to war? Who are we to actually engage in the war the way wars should be fought? That's so selfish and egoistic. What about the duty to help your enemy and to serve your enemy and to make sure that they're comfortable and they're happy and they build democracies for them and build sewer systems and educational systems for them, whether they want them or not? So everything about how we engage in war and how we coddle radical Islam is ultimately the fault of Immanuel Kant. So what's the moral status of advocating for the boycott of an immoral business? Well, I think it's morally right to advocate for the boycott of an immoral business. As a business is run by immoral people, why would you want to have anything to do with it? Now, put aside the particulars, right? How you decide whether a business is immoral, that's not always easy. That is to say, somebody is immoral or has immoral business practices, you need to be able to prove that. You need to be have it clear in your mind that it's truly immoral. But if it is, if they're doing something that you believe is harmful, not harmful in the sense of rights violating, but harmful in a sense that it's not pursuing their own self-interest and therefore potentially hurting other people's interests, again, not in a rights-violating way, then why would you deal with them? I mean, take a restaurant that puts on its window, no Jews allowed. Now, I would never go into a restaurant like that, if whether I was Jewish or not. I happen to be Jewish, so they wouldn't let me in anyway. But I believe they have a right to do it. I believe they have a right to do it. That's probably very controversial. It's your restaurant. You can invite whoever you want to into it. I only invite people I like into my house. And the criteria that I evaluate who I like and who I don't like is mine. It's none of anybody else's business. A restaurant is just an extension of my house. If it's private property, it's private property. It means you get to decide who to invite and who don't. Now, if somebody puts out something so stupidly irrational as no Jews, no blacks, whatever, no whites, or whatever it happens to be into my restaurant, that is the kind of person you don't want to deal with. I don't want to deal with racists. I don't want to deal with bigots. I don't want to deal with irrational people, immoral people. Life is too short. So I would boycott that restaurant and encourage my friends to boycott that restaurant. I might even demonstrate outside that restaurant, encourage other people, strangers, not to eat at that restaurant. I don't want irrational people in my community. I don't want irrational people expressing their completely irrational, bigoted, racist views in my community. I have a right to do it. But if I can, without using force, prevent them from doing it, so be it. And I don't believe boycotting is force. Going into a restaurant is a choice. It's a voluntary transaction. Not engaging in that transaction is a choice. That's also voluntary. Encouraging other people by use of reason, not by use of force, but by use of reason, is not coercion. So absolutely, I am for boycotting irrational businesses. And the problem today is that almost everybody, all these businesses engage in irrational stuff, primarily because the government forces them to do it. So I can't really blame them for that. But if I knew, I don't know, if I knew my dry cleaner beat his wife every night, I wouldn't take my business to him. I'm not going to support a guy who beats his wife. But that's a rights violation, so he should go to jail, you would argue. If you were sending money to ISIS,
I wouldn't go.
Okay, well, that's a rights violation. Here we go. What would be something B that's not a rights violation? I don't know. If it was supporting an environmentalist organization, if he was, I mean, the things that I would not support if I knew about them, and I would stop supporting those businesses. So absolutely, it's completely appropriate to do that. Okay, so in the transfer from the mixed economy to capitalism, what would happen to the treasury? And here he means the gold that the government has. Would it be distributed to people relative to the amount of taxes they paid? No, I don't think so. I think what would happen is what would happen to all government property that it owns today. And gold is just one form of that. What about all the land and all that? I think given that the government has so many debts, I think it would all be auctioned off and used to pay off the debts so that it would allow the government to shrink much faster and reduce taxes much faster. So I would put in the auction block every piece of property the government owns, you know, and the government owns like over 75%, state, local, and federal government owns over 75% of all the land west of the Mississippi. I don't know if you knew that, 75%. So when you drive through the desert in Nevada, New Mexico, and in Utah, the government owns most of that. Even in California, when you drive in the forests, the government owns much of that land. Sell it all. There's got to be trillions of dollars there. It's a great way to pay off the debt without raising taxes. You know, if we didn't have all that debt, I would argue for homesteading. Just say, whoever uses it, go for it, right? But we have the debt, and it makes sense to pay off as much of it as we can. So I would say sell it all, including the gold, and that's it. Okay, so this is a question about Cuba. How should we think about normalizing relations with Cuba? So this is the issue. And I'm going to differentiate the number of different levels of relationships with countries. One, the principle is this. If a country is a threat to the United States, if it is actively engaged in threatening activities towards your country, and I can think of North Korea as an example, Iran as an example. Right now, you know, those might be the only two countries. Maybe Venezuela, though probably not. Or massive rights violations against Americans. They're confiscating American wealth. They're confiscating American property. I would say that those shouldn't be embargoed. It should be government policy that you cannot trade with them because you're helping an enemy of the United States. So there should be the State Department should publish a list, whether it's two countries, five countries, no countries, of the enemies of the United States. And those enemies, we should have no diplomatic relations. We should have no negotiations. And we should have no trade with those countries. Then there's a second list of just immoral countries, countries that are bad countries, but are not threatening to the United States. These are countries that do horrific things to their own people, that violate their own people's rights, where no property rights are respected. But they're not a threat. Cuba would be one of these countries. Saudi Arabia would be one of these countries. Countries like that, I think, we should not restrict trade, but the government should say, look, you trade at your own risk. We're not going to go to war to, if they steal your property, that's your problem. We're warning you. These countries are bad countries. You want to trade with them, trade with them. But we're not going to rush to defend you if something happens, right? And also, I think we should not have diplomatic relations with those countries. We should not have an embassy there. Embassies mean that we recognize the sovereignty of the country. I don't recognize the sovereignty of the Castros over Cuba. I don't recognize the sovereignty of the king over Saudi Arabia. That's ridiculous. Kings don't have sovereignty. Dictators don't have a sovereignty. So in other words, the United States should not have an embassy in any dictatorship. And then the third category are countries that we both trade with, we have embassies with, we negotiate with, we have treaties with, we work to protect property rights of Americans in those countries. And those are countries that we deem as basically free. They're not going to be laissez-faire capitalist, but basically free. Yeah, Western Europe, Israel, much of Southeast Asia. And, you know, you've got some countries that are difficult to figure out. Russia right now with Putin. Is it a threat to the United States? Is it so authoritarian that you put it on the no diplomatic relations list? Is there still enough freedom there that you still have an embassy? These are tricky questions, and that's what you need a president and a Congress and a State Department to actually think through and figure out and do the hard work that's necessary to figure those things out. And you're going to make mistakes once in a while, and you're going to have to be able to admit those and to reverse course when necessary. So in my view, with Cuba, all the trade embargo should go. We should be allowed to trade freely with them, but no diplomatic relations.
If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peekoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most important novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And I might add that it wouldn't hurt you to read my latest book, The Dim Hypothesis.